Hello again. This is Mrs. English, and I will be reading to you today from Homer's Iliad, the Richmond Lattimore translation. The Richmond Lattimore translation of Homer's Iliad, and I am reading from Book 18. In this book, Antilochus, the swift-footed son of Nestor, unfortunate Antilochus, has been given the job to go back to the camp and tell Achilles that Patroclus is dead. So he's taken out of the battle. He has to run down to the ships, find Achilles, tell him that his good friend Patroclus is dead. And of course, this will give Achilles a reason. His anger and hatred for Hector will actually outweigh his anger and hatred of Agamemnon, and he will rejoin the battle. And when this book ends, when Book 18 ends, we will find out how Achilles is able to go back into battle, because the first thing he needs to do is put on his armor, right? And he has no armor. Book 18. So these fought on in the likeness of blazing fire. And of course, we are talking about the two Iontes from Book 17, who fight off the Trojans while the Greeks get the body of Patroclus back. And this is would be Telamonian Ius and then Ius the Lesser. So these fought on in the likeness of blazing fire. Meanwhile, Antilochus came, a swift-footed messenger, to Achilles, and found him sitting in front of the steep-horned ships, thinking over in his heart of things which had now been accomplished. Disturbed. All right, line 5. Achilles looks up. He sees someone running back to him. Disturbed, Achilles spoke to the spirit in his own great heart. Ah, me! How is it that once again the flowing-haired Achaeans are driven out of the plain on their ships in fear and confusion? They're all running back to the ships. May the gods not accomplish vile sorrows upon the heart in me, in the way my mother once made it clear to me, when she told me how, while I yet lived, the bravest of all the Myrmidons must leave the light of the sun beneath the hands of the Trojans. Surely, then, the strong son of Menoetius, and that is Patroclus, has perished. Unhappy, and yet I told him, once he had beaten the fierce fire off, to come back to the ships, not fight in strength against Hector. Now, as he was pondering this in his heart and spirit, meanwhile the son of stately Nestor was drawing near him, and wept warm tears, and gave Achilles his sorrowful message. Ah, me, son of valiant Peleus, you must hear from me the ghastly message of a thing I wish never had happened. Patroclus has fallen, and now they are fighting over his body, which is naked. Hector of the Shining Helm has taken his armor. He spoke, and the black cloud of sorrow closed on Achilles. In both hands he caught up the grimy dust and poured it over his head and face, and fouled his handsome countenance, and the black ashes were scattered over his immortal tunic. Line 25. Of course, this is mourning and ashes, putting dust and ashes on your head. It's an ancient form of mourning. And he himself, mightily in his might, in the dust lay at length, and took and tore at his hair with his hands and defiled it. And the handmaidens Achilles and Patroclus had taken captive, stricken at heart, cried out aloud, and came running out of doors about valiant Achilles. And all of them beat their breasts with their hands, and the limbs went slack in each of them. On the other side, Antilochus mourned with him, letting the tears fall. And here we have an interesting line in line 33. Antilochus is pretty smart. No one wants to go and tell Achilles that his friend is killed. And so he mourns with him and held the hands of Achilles as he grieved in his proud heart, fearing Achilles might cut his throat with the iron. He cried out terribly loud, and the lady, his mother, heard him as she sat in the depths of the sea at the side of her aged father. Her aged father is Nereus, the old man in the sea, and all of his daughters are called Nereids. This is Nereus. And she cried shrill in turn, and the goddesses gathered about her, who all along the depth of the sea were daughters of Nereus. For Glauce was there, Caimodice and Thalea, Nisai and Spio and Tho, and ox-eyed Halia. Camothao was there, Actea and Limnorai, Melite and Iari, Amphithoe and Agu, Dato and Prato, Dynamini and Ferusa, Dexamini and Amphinomi, and Calianera, Doris and Penope and glorious Galatea, Nemertes and Apsuides and Calianassa. Clymene was there, Ianera and Inassa, Mera and Orithyai and lovely-haired Amathea, and the rest who along the depth of the sea were daughters of Nereus. The silvery cave was filled with these, and together all of them beat their breasts, and among them Thetis, Achilles' mother, led out the threnody, and a threnody would be a funeral mourning, a type of lamentation, and this is her threnody. Hear me, Nereids, my sisters, so you may all know well all the sorrows that are in my heart when you hear of them from me. Ah me, my sorrow, the bitterness in this best of childbearing. Since I gave birth to a son who was without fault and powerful, conspicuous among heroes, and he shot up like a young tree, and I nurtured him like a tree grown in the pride of the orchard. I sent him away with the curved ships into the land of Ilion to fight with the Trojans, but I shall never again receive him one home again to his country and into the house of Peleus. Yet while I see him live and he looks on the sunlight, he has sorrows, and though I go to him, I can do nothing to help him. It was very interesting that this goddess is mourning for her son Achilles as though he's dead and he's still alive. Yet I shall go to look on my dear son and to listen to the sorrow that has come to him as he stays back from the fighting. Line 65. So she spoke and left the cave, and the others together went with her in tears, and about them the wave of the water was broken. Now these, when they came to the generous Troad, followed each other out on the seashore, where, close together, the ships of the Myrmidons were hauled up about swift Achilles. There, as he sighed heavily, the lady, his mother, stood by him. This is Thetis coming to her son Achilles, and cried out shrill and aloud, and took her son's head in her arms. Then, sorrowing for him, she spoke to him in winged words. Why, then, child, do you lament? What sorrow has come to your heart now? Speak out, do not hide it. These things are brought to accomplishment through Zeus, in the way that you lifted your hands and prayed for, that all the sons of the Achaeans be pinned on their grounded vessels by reason of your loss, and suffer things that are shameful. So Thetis is saying to him, why are you so sorrowful? All of your prayers have been answered. Then, sighing heavily, Achilles of the swift feet answered her, my mother, all these things the Olympian brought to accomplishment. But what pleasure is this to me, since my dear companion has perished? Line 80. Patroclus, who I loved beyond all other companions, as well as my own life, I have lost him. And this word lost can also be destroyed, which is a different interpretation if you read it. I have destroyed him. And Hector, who killed him, has stripped away that gigantic armor, a wonder to look on and splendid, which the gods gave Peleus, his father, a glorious present, on that day they drove you to the marriage bed of a mortal. Line 85. Interesting to check out right now would be Book 16, line 143. I wish you had gone on living in with the other goddesses of the sea, and that Peleus had married some mortal woman. As it is, there must be on your heart a numberless sorrow for your son's death, since you can never again receive him one home again to his own country, since the spirit within does not drive me to go on living and be among men, except on condition that Hector first be beaten down under my spear, lose his life, and pay the price for stripping Patroclus, the son of Menoetius. Then in turn Thetis spoke to him, letting the tears fall. Then I must lose you soon, my child, by what you are saying, since it is decreed your death must come soon after Hector's. And so apparently this is what fate has decreed. All the gods cannot change it, and she shares this with him. Then, deeply disturbed, Achilles of the swift feet answered her, I must die soon, then, since I was not to stand by my companion when he was killed, and now, far away from the land of his fathers, he has perished, and lacked my fighting strength to defend him. Line 100. And now, since I am not going back to the beloved land of my fathers, since I was no light of safety to Patroclus, nor to my other companions, who in their numbers went down before glorious Hector, but sit here beside my ships, a useless weight on the good land. This is how Achilles refers to himself. He now realizes he's left his men, his friend Patroclus is dead, either lost or destroyed. His anger now at Hector is more than his anger at Agamemnon, and he's calling himself a useless weight on the good land. Line 105. I, who am such as no other of the bronze-armored Achaeans in battle, though there are others also better in council, why, I wish that strife would vanish away from among gods and mortals and Gaul, which makes a man grow angry for all his great mind, that gall of anger that swarms like smoke inside of a man's heart, and becomes a thing sweeter to him by far than the dripping of honey. So it was here that the lord of men, Agamemnon, angered me. Still, we will let all this be a thing of the past, and for all our sorrow beat down by force the anger deeply within us. Now I shall go to overtake that killer of a dear life, Hector. Then I will accept my own death, at whatever time Zeus wishes to bring it about. And the other immortals, for not even the strength of Heracles fled away from destruction, although he was dearest of all to Lord Zeus, son of Cronos, but his fate beat him under, and the wearisome anger of Hera. So I likewise, if such is the fate which has been wrought for me, shall lie still when I am dead. Now I must win excellent glory, Phaios, and drive some one of the women of Troy, or some deep-girdled Dardanian woman, lifting up to her soft cheeks both hands to wipe away the close bursts of tears in her lamentation, and learn that I stayed too long out of the fighting. Do not hold me back from the fight, though you love me. You will not persuade me. In turn, the goddess Thetis of the silver feet answered him, Yes, it is true, my child. This is no cowardly action, to beat aside sudden death from your afflicted companions. Yet see now, your splendid armor, all glaring and brazen, is held among the Trojans, and Hector of the shining helmet wears it on his own shoulders and glories in it. Yet I think he will not glory for long, since his death stands very close to him. Therefore, do not yet go into the grind of the war god, not before with your own eyes you see me come back to you. For I am coming to you at dawn, and as the sun rises, bringing splendid armor to you from the lord Hephaestus. So Thetis tells Achilles, Yes, it's good to beat down your anger at Agamemnon and join the battle. However, you don't have any armor. Hector's wearing it. Hector's glowing in it. Don't go until I come back to you. And what is she going to bring him? Splendid armor from Hephaestus. So she spoke and turned and went away from her son. And turning now to her sisters of the sea, she spoke to them. Do you now go back into the wide fold of the water to visit the ancient of the sea and the house of our father and tell him everything. I am going to tall Olympus and to Hephaestus, the glorious smith, if he might be willing to give me for my son renowned and radiant armor. She spoke, line 145, and they plunged back beneath the wave of the water, while she, the goddess Thetis of the silver feet, went onward to Olympus to bring back to her son the glorious armor. So her feet carried her to Olympus. Meanwhile, the Achaeans, with inhuman clamor before the attack of man-slaughtering Hector, fled until they were making for their own ships and the Hellespont. Nor could the strong-grieved Achaeans have dragged the body of Patroclus, henchman of Achilles, from under the missiles, for once again the men and the horses came over upon him, and Hector, Priam's son, who fought like a flame in his fury, three times from behind glorious Hector, caught him by the feet, trying to drag him, and called aloud on the Trojans. Three times the two Iontes, Ajax and Ajax, with their battle fury upon them, beat him from the corpse, but he, steady in the confidence of his great strength, kept making, now a rush into the crowd, or again at another time stood fast with his great cry, but gave not a bit of ground backward. 160. And what was it like as they dash and pull on Patroclus's body? And as herdsmen who dwell in the fields are not able to frighten a tawny lion in his great hunger away from a carcass, so the two Iontes, marshals of men, were not able to scare Hector, Priam's son, away from the body. And now he would have dragged it away and won glory forever, line 165. This can also be translated as glory unspeakable. Had not swift-footed Iris come running from Olympus with a message for Peleus' son to arm. She came secretly from Zeus and the other gods, since it was Hera who sent her. She came and stood close to him and addressed him in winged words. Rise up, son of Peleus, most terrifying of all men. Defend Patroclus, for whose sake the terrible fighting stands now in front of the ships. They are destroying each other. The Achaeans fight in defense over the fallen body of Patroclus, while the others, the Trojans, are rushing to drag the corpse off to windy Ilion, and beyond all, glorious Hector rages to haul it away, since the anger within him is urgent to cut the head from the soft neck and set it on sharp stakes. Up then, lie here no longer. Let shame come into your heart, lest Patroclus become sport for the dogs of Troy to worry. Your shame, if the body goes from here with defilement upon it. So the body is almost back to the ships, and Iris is sent from Hera to tell Achilles, go out there and fight. Get Patroclus's body, or you're going to be shamed. Then in turn Achilles of the swift feet answered her, "Divine Iris, what god sent you to me with a message?" Then in turn swift-footed Iris spoke to him, "Hera sent me, the honored wife of Zeus, but the son of Cronos, who sits on high, does not know this, nor any other immortal of all those who dwell by the snows of Olympus." Then in answer to her spoke Achilles of the swift feet, "How shall I go into the fighting? They have my armor, and my beloved mother told me I must not be armored, not before with my own eyes I see her come back to me. She promised she would bring me magnificent arms from Hephaestus, nor do I know of another whose glorious armor I could wear, unless it were the great shield of Telamonian Aias. But he himself wears it, I think, and goes in the foremost of the spear fight over the body of fallen Patroclus." Then in turn swift-footed Iris spoke to him, "Yes, we all know well how they hold your glorious armor, but go to the ditch and show yourself as you are to the Trojans, if perhaps the Trojans might be frightened and give way from their attack, and the fighting sons of the Achaeans get wind again after hard work. There is little breathing space in the fighting. So Iris wants Achilles just to go show himself, go stand by the ditch and just show himself to the Trojans in case that might scare them away. Line 202. So speaking, Iris of the swift feet went away from him, but Achilles, the beloved of Zeus, rose up, and Athena swept about his powerful shoulders the fluttering Aegis, and she, the divine among goddesses, about his head circled a golden cloud, and kindled from it a flame far shining. So Achilles rises up, and Athena puts the Aegis around his shoulders, and then around his head she puts a golden cloud and she kindles it. Remember, she's shown as a falling star, she's shown as different things, and she's kindled it so it looks like it's flaming, a flame that far shines. So this is a long, bright flame. He's glowing kind of like fire, and of course the darkness is in this background. As what's it like? As when a flare goes up into the high air from a city, from an island far away, with enemies fighting about it, who all day long are in the hateful division of Ares, fighting from their own city. But as the sun goes down, a signal fire blazes out one after another, so that the glare goes pulsing high for men of the neighboring islands to see it, in case they might come over in ships to beat off the enemy. Right? Would they send signal flares? This is what it's like. That's the metaphor. So from the head of Achilles, the blaze shot into the bright air. He went from the wall and stood by the ditch, nor mixed with the other Achaeans, since he followed the close command of his mother. There he stood and shouted, and from her place Pallas Athena gave cry and drove an endless terror upon the Trojans. All right, the sun is just setting, and it's just like when they light signal fires to see if they can get neighboring enemies to come over. That's what this blazing crown of light looks like against the setting sun. And now, as he shouts, Pallas Athena shouts. As loud, what was it like? As loud as comes the voice that is screamed out by a trumpet, by murderous attackers who beleaguer a city, so then high and clear went up the voice of Iokides. And of course this is Achilles. But the Trojans, when they heard the brazen voice of Iokides, the heart was shaken in all, and the very floating maned horses turned their chariots about, since their hearts saw the coming afflictions. The charioteers were dumbfounded as they saw the unwearied, dangerous fire that played above the head of great-hearted Pelion, Achilles, blazing and kindled by the goddess gray-eyed Athena. 3 times across the ditch, brilliant Achilles gave his great cry, and 3 times the Trojans and their renowned companions were routed. There, at that time, 12 of the best men among them perished upon their own chariots and spears. Meanwhile, the Achaeans gladly pulled Patroclus's body out from under the missiles and set him upon a litter, and his own companions about him stood mourning. And along with them swift-footed Achilles went, letting fall warm tears as he saw his steadfast companion lying there on a carried litter and torn with the sharp bronze, the man he had sent off before with horses and chariot into the fighting, who never again came home to be welcomed. And of course, in Homeric literature, a homecoming, being welcomed home, is a major theme. Now the lady Hera of the Ox-Eyes drove the unwilling, weariless sun god to sink in the depth of the ocean, line 240. and the sun went down, and the brilliant Achaeans gave over their strong fighting and the doubtful collision of battle. The Trojans, on the other side, moved from the strong encounter in their turn, and unyoked their running horses from under the chariots, and gathered into assembly before taking thought for their supper. They stood on their feet in assembly, nor did any man have the patience to sit down, but the terror was on them all, seeing that Achilles had appeared, after he had stayed so long from the difficult fighting. First to speak among them was the careful Polydamas, Panthous's son, who alone of them looked before and behind him, line 250. He was companion to Hector, and born on the same night with him. And so this Polydamas was born on the same night as Hector, which might mean something as far as augury, and they read, you know, their fortunes and things, and with this superstitious pagan belief, this would mean something, that Polydamas was born on the same night of Hector. But he was better in words, the other with the spear far better. He, in kind intention, stood forth and addressed them. Now take careful thought, dear friends, for I myself urge you to go back into the city and not wait for the divine dawn in the plain beside the ships. We are too far from the wall now. While this man was still angry with great Agamemnon, for all that time the Achaeans were easy men to fight with. And so they can see already, Achilles was angry with Agamemnon, he was easy, the Greeks were easier to fight with without Achilles. But now who is he angry at? Now he's angry at Hector. For I also used then to be one who was glad to sleep out near their ships, and I hoped to capture the oar-swept vessels. But now I terribly dread the swift-footed son of Peleus. So violent is the valor in him. He will not be willing to stay here in the plain, where now Achaeans and Trojans from either side sunder between them the wrath of the war god. With him the fight will be for the sake of our city and women. Let us go into the town. Believe me, thus it will happen. For this present immortal night has stopped the swift-footed son of Peleus. But if he catches us still in this place tomorrow, and drives upon us in arms, a man will be well aware of him, be glad to get back into sacred Ilion. The man who escapes, there will be many Trojans the vultures and dogs will feed upon. But let such a word be out of my hearing. If all of us will do as I say, though it hurts us to do it, this night we will hold our strength in the marketplace, and the great walls, and the gateways, and the long smooth plain, close-joined gate timbers that close to fit them shall defend our city. Then, early in the morning, under dawn, we shall arm ourselves in our war gear, and take stations along the walls. The worse for him if he endeavors to come away from the ships and fight us here for our city. Line 280. Back he must go to his ships again when he wears out the strong necks of his horses, driving them at a gallop everywhere by the city. His valor will not give him leave to burst in upon us nor sack our town, okay, because they'll be safe behind the walls. Sooner the circling dogs will feed on him. Then, looking darkly at him, Hector of the Shining Helm spoke. Polydamas, these things that you argue please me no longer when you tell us to go back again and be cooped in our city. Have you not all had your glut of being fenced in our outworks? There was a time when mortal men would speak of the city of Priam as a place with much gold and much bronze, but now the lovely treasures that lay away in our houses have vanished. Line 290. And many possessions have been sold and gone into Phrygia and into Maeonia the lovely, when great Zeus was angry. But now, when the son of devious devising Cronos has given me the winning of glory by the ships to pin the Achaeans on the sea, why, fool, no longer show these thoughts to our people. Not one of the Trojans will obey you. I shall not allow it. Come then, do as I say, and let us all be persuaded. Now, take your supper by positions along the encampment, and do not forget your watch, and let every man be wakeful. And if any Trojan is strongly concerned about his possessions, line 300, let him gather them and give them to the people to use them in common. It is better for one of us to enjoy them than for the Achaeans. In the morning, under dawn, we shall arm ourselves in our war gear and waken the bitter god of war by the hollow vessels. If it is true that brilliant Achilles is risen beside their ships, then the worse for him if he tries it, since I, for my part, will not run from him out of the sorrowful battle, but rather stand fast to see if he wins the great glory or if I can win it. This is a different word for glory. This is a mega kratos. The war god is impartial. Before now he has killed the killer. So spoke Hector, and the Trojans thundered to hear him. Line 310. Fools, since Pallas Athena had taken away the wits from them. They gave their applause to Hector in his counsel of evil, but none to Polydamas, who had spoken good sense before them. They took their supper along the encampment. Meanwhile the Achaeans mourned all night in lamentation over Patroclus. Peleus's son, Achilles, led the thronging chant of their lamentation, and laid his manslaughtering hands over the chest of his dear friend with outbursts of incessant grief. And what was it like as Achilles mourns his friend? As some great bearded lion, when some man, a deer hunter, has stolen his cubs away from him out of the close wood, the lion comes back too late and is anguished and turns into many valleys, quartering after the man's trail on the chance of finding him and taken with bitter anger, so he, groaning heavily, spoke out to the Myrmidons. And, of course, these are Achilles' people. And so Achilles' lament is just like a lion roaring, lamenting that it has come back too late to find that its cubs are gone. Ah, me! It was an empty word I cast forth on that day when in the halls I tried to comfort the hero Menoetius, the father of Patroclus. I told him I would bring back his son in glory to Apuus with Ilion sacked, and bring his share of war spoils allotted. All right, so we find here that Achilles promised Patroclus' father, Menoetius, that he'd bring back his son in glory, with Ilion sacked, and his share of the war spoils. But Zeus does not bring to accomplishment all thoughts in men's minds. Thus it is destiny for us both to stain the same soil here in Troy, he and Patroclus, since I shall never come home. And my father, Peleus, the aged rider, will not welcome me in his great house, nor Thetis my mother, but in this place the earth will receive me. But seeing that it is I, Patroclus, who follow you underground, I will not bury you till I bring to this place the armor and the head of Hector. So now Achilles is actually speaking to the body of Patroclus. It is I, Patroclus, who follow you underground. I will not bury you till I bring to this place the armor and the head of Hector, since he was your great-hearted murderer. Before your burning pyre, I shall behead 12 glorious children of the Trojans. And here we see the problem of Achilles' anger again. Achilles has the anger of a god. His anger is way, way, way out of proportion. Way out of proportion. He's going to behead 12 glorious young men or children of the Trojans for my anger over your slaying. And of course, the Greeks don't practice a sacrifice, a human sacrifice, only on rare occasions, usually associated with Artemis, and it's always evil, it's always bad. This is Achilles making a promise. He's going to capture these 12 men. If you're making notes, he'll capture these 12 young men in book 21 at line 26, and he will kill them in book 23 at line 175. Line 338. Until then, you shall lie where you are in front of my curved ships, and beside you women of Troy and deep-girdled Dardanian women shall sorrow for you night and day and shed tears for you, those whom you and I worked hard to capture by force and the long spear in days when we were storming the rich cities of mortals. And this is interesting that Achilles tells us that the women that they stole, the women that they captured by force when they were storming these rich cities, these women are even in mourning, and they will be in mourning over Patroclus. And why would that be? They may sense that Achilles is next, but regardless, they are now very much endangered, because if something happens to Achilles now, their fates are completely unknown. They'll be passed off again to other masters or killed. Who knows? They have good cause to be in mourning. Line 343. So speaking, brilliant Achilles gave orders to his companions to set a great cauldron across the fire, so that with all speed they could wash away the clotted blood from Patroclus. They set up over the blaze of the fire a bath, water cauldron, and poured water into it, and put logs underneath, and kindled them. The fire worked on the swell of the cauldron, and the water heated. But when the water had come to a boil in the shining bronze, then they washed the body, and anointed it softly with olive oil, and stopped the gashes in his body with stored-up unguents, and laid him on a bed, and shrouded him in a thin sheet from head to foot, and covered that over with a white mantle. And of course, why are they preparing the body? Up until less than 100 years ago, if someone was killed, if someone died, the family prepared the body. Then all night long, gathered about Achilles of the swift feet, the Myrmidons mourned for Patroclus and lamented over him. But Zeus spoke to Hera, who was his wife and his sister, "So you have acted then, Lady Hera of the Ox Eyes. You've roused up Achilles of the swift feet. It must be then that the flowing-haired Achaeans are born of your own generation." Then the goddess, the ox-eyed Lady Hera, answered him, "Majesty, son of Cronus, what sort of thing have you spoken? Even one who is mortal will try to accomplish his purpose for another, though he be a man and knows not such wisdom as we do. As for me, then, who claim I am highest of all the goddesses, both ways, since I am eldest born, and am called your consort, line 365, yours, and you in turn are lord over all the immortals, how could I not weave sorrows for the men of Troy, when I hate them?" And now, as these two were saying things like this to each other, Thetis of the Silver Feet came to the house of Hephaestus, imperishable, starry, and shining among the immortals, built in bronze for himself by the god of the dragging footsteps. So Hephaestus built it for himself. She found him sweating as he turned here and there to his bellows busily, since he was working on 20 tripods, which were to stand against the wall of his strong-founded dwelling. And he had set golden wheels underneath the base of each one, so that on their own motion they could wheel into the immortal gathering and return to his house. Kind of a tray on wheels, or a tripod, a bowl, or it can also serve as a chair on little wheels. He can push it back and forth from his house to the immortal gathering. A wonder to look at. These were so far finished, but the elaborate ear handles were not yet on. He was forging these and beating the chains out. As he was at work on this in his craftsmanship and his cunning, line 380, meanwhile the goddess Thetis, the silver-footed, drew near him. Charis of the shining veil saw her as she came forward, and of course you could interpret this as grace also. The Greek word charis is grace. Grace of the shining veil saw her as she came forward. She, the lovely goddess, the renowned strong-armed one, had married. She came and caught her hand and called her by name and spoke to her. "Why is it, Thetis of the light robes, you've come to our house now?" And so this is Hephaestus's wife, Charis, or Grace, according to Homer, who is greeting Thetis, their guest, and says, "Why have you come to our house now?" Line 385. "We honor you and love you, but you have not come much before this, but come in with me, so I may put entertainment before you." They're going to practice some Xenia. She spoke, and, shining among divinities, led the way forward and made Thetis sit down in a chair that was wrought elaborately and splendid with silver nails, think of those as studs, and under it was a footstool. She called to Hephaestus, the renowned smith, and spoke a word to him. "Hephaestus, come this way. Here is Thetis, who has need of you." Hearing her, the renowned smith of the strong arms answered her, "Then there is a goddess we honor and respect in our house. She saved me when I suffered much at the time of my great fall through the will of my own brazen-faced mother, who wanted to hide me for being lame. Then my soul would have taken much suffering had not Eurynome and Thetis caught me and held me. Eurynome, daughter of Ocean, or Oceanus, whose stream bends back in a circle, with them I worked 9 years as a smith and wrought many intricate things, pins that bend back, curved clasps, cups, necklaces, working there in the hollow of the cave, and the stream of ocean around us went on forever with its foam and its murmur. No other among the gods or among mortal men knew about us except Eurynome and Thetis. They knew, since they saved me. Now she has come into our house, so I must by all means do everything to give recompense to lovely-haired Thetis for my life." And so why does Hephaestus feel he owes anything to Thetis? She saved his life one time, and he will do anything for her. "Therefore, set out before her fair entertainment while I'm putting away my bellows and all my instruments." He spoke, line 410, and took the huge blower off from the block of the anvil, limping, and yet his shrunken legs moved lightly beneath him. He set the bellows away from the fire and gathered and put away all the tools with which he worked in a silver strongbox. Then, with a sponge, he wiped clean his forehead and both hands and his massive neck and hairy chest, and put on a tunic, and took up a heavy stick in his hand, and went to the doorway, limping. And in support of their master moved his attendants. These are golden, and in appearance like living young women. There is intelligence in their hearts, and there is speech in them, and strength, and from the immortal gods they have learned how to do things. These are Hephaestus's servants, who are like female robots. These stirred nimbly in support of their master, and moving near to where Thetis sat in her shining chair, Hephaestus caught her by the hand and called her by name and spoke a word to her. "Why is it, Thetis of the light robes, you have come to our house now?" Line 425. "We honor you and love you, but you have not come much before this. Speak forth what is on your mind. My heart is urgent to do it if I can, and if it's a thing that can be accomplished." Then in turn Thetis answered him, letting the tears fall. "Hephaestus, is there among all the goddesses on Olympus one who in her heart has endured so many grim sorrows as the griefs Zeus, son of Cronos, has given me beyond others? Of all the other sisters of the sea, he gave me to a mortal, to Peleus, Iacchus's son, and I had to endure mortal marriage, though much against my will, and now he, broken by mournful old age, lies away in his halls." So her husband Peleus had become old, old, old. "Yet I have other troubles, for since he's given me a son to bear and to raise up conspicuous among heroes, and he shot up like a young tree, I nurtured him like a tree grown in the pride of the orchard. I sent him away in the curved ships to the land of Ilion to fight with the Trojans, but I shall never again receive him one home again to his country and into the house of Peleus. Yet while I see him live, and he looks on the sunlight, he has sorrows, and though I go to him, I can do nothing to help him. And the girl the sons of the Achaeans chose out for his honor, powerful Agamemnon took her away again out of his hands." Line 445. "For her his heart has been wasting in sorrow. But meanwhile the Trojans pinned the Achaeans against their grounded ships, and would not let them win outside, and the elders of the Argives, the Greeks, entreated my son, and named the many glorious gifts they would give him. But at that time he refused himself to fight the death from them. Nevertheless, he put his own armor upon Patroclus and sent him into the fighting and gave many men to go with him. All day they fought about the Scaean gates," those are the Trojan gates, "and on that day they would have stormed the city if only Phoebus Apollo had not killed the fighting son of Menoetius, Patroclus, there in the first ranks after he had wrought much damage and given the glory to Hector. Therefore now I come to your knees." So she's supplicating. Thetis is supplicating Hephaestus. "So might you be willing to give me, for my short-lived son, a shield and a helmet, and two beautiful greaves fitted with clasps for the ankles, and a corselet." What does Thetis want? She's got a list. A shield, a helmet, two beautiful greaves fitted with clasps for the ankles, and a corselet. What he had was lost with his steadfast companion when the Trojans killed him. Now my son lies on the ground, heart sorrowing. You can imagine Achilles lying on the ground, beating the ground for Patroclus with a regular royal demigod fit, perhaps. Hearing her, the renowned smith of the strong arms answered her, "Do not fear. Let not these things be a thought in your mind. And I wish that I could hide him away from death and its sorrow at that time when his hard fate comes upon him, as surely as there shall be fine armor for him, such as another man out of many shall wonder at it when he looks on it." So he spoke and left her there, and went to his bellows. He turned these toward the fire, okay, the bellows, and gave them their orders for working. And the bellows, all 20 of them, blew on the crucibles, line 470, from all directions blasting wind to blow the flames high now as he hurried to be at this place and now at another, wherever Hephaestus might wish them to blow, and the work went forward. He cast on the fire bronze which is weariless, and tin with it, and valuable gold and silver, and thereafter set forth upon its standard the great anvil, and gripped in one hand the ponderous hammer, while in the other he grasped the pincers. First of all, he forged a shield that was huge and heavy, elaborating it about, and threw around it a shining triple rim that glittered, line 480, and the shield strap was cast of silver. There were 5 folds composing the shield itself, and upon it he elaborated many things in his skill and craftsmanship. He made, all right, and what does he put on the shield? He elaborated many things, and so this is the design of the shield, what it looks like. He made the earth upon it, and the sky, and the sea's water, and the tireless sun, and the moon waxing into her fullness, and on it all the constellations that festoon the heavens, the Pleiades and the Hyades and the strength of Orion and the Bear, whom men give also the name of the Wagon, who turns about in a fixed place and looks at Orion, and she alone is never plunged in the wash of the ocean. On it he wrought in all their beauty two cities of mortal men. All right, so first he works on it. It wouldn't be a carving, but he shapes onto it the moon and all the constellations, the sun, all these different constellations. And now, line 490, two cities of mortal men. And there were marriages in one and festivals. They were leading the brides along the city from their maiden chambers under the flaring of torches, and a loud bride song was arising. The young men followed the circles of the dance, and among them the flutes and lyres kept up their clamor, as in the meantime the women, standing each at the door of her court, admired them. The people were assembled in the marketplace, where a quarrel had arisen, and two men were disputing over the blood price for a man who had been killed. And, of course, what would the blood price be? And that's a fascinating side note, because if you kill a man, then you're either starting a feud, you're going to have a never-ending vendetta, or you must agree on the worth of a man. How much was this man worth? How much could you give me for this person I love or in my family that you killed, so that I will not start this feud and have to kill you or make you have to run away to some safe city? One man promised full restitution in a public statement, but the other refused and would accept nothing. Both men made for an arbitrator to have a decision, and people were speaking up on either side to help both men. This is all displayed on this shield, shown on this shield. Line 503. But the heralds kept the people in hand, as meanwhile the elders were in session on benches of polished stone in the sacred circle, and held in their hands the staves of the heralds who lift their voices. This sacred circle is fascinating because, of course, on the citadel of Mycenae, which is where Agamemnon was king, there is such a circle, and many Mycenaean age ruins have this type of circle. The two men rushed before these and took turns speaking their cases, and between them lay on the ground 2 talents of gold to be given to that judge who in this case spoke the straightest opinion. But around the other city were lying 2 forces of armed men, shining in their war gear. For one side, counsel was divided, whether storm and sack, or share between both sides the property and all the possessions the lovely citadel held hard within it. But the city's people were not giving way and armed for an ambush. Their beloved wives and their little children stood on the rampart to hold it, and with them the men with age upon them. But meanwhile the others went out, and Ares led them in Pallas Athena. These were gold, both, and golden raiment upon them, and they were beautiful and huge in their armor, being divinities, and conspicuous from afar, but the people around them were smaller. This is how Hephaestus fashioned this shield. Ares and Pallas Athena are done all in gold, and they're larger than the people. Line 520. These, when they were come to the place that was set for their ambush, in a river where there was a watering place for all animals, there they sat down in place, shrouding themselves in the bright bronze. But, apart from these, were sitting 2 men to watch for the rest of them, and waiting until they could see the sheep and the shambling cattle, who appeared presently, and 2 herdsmen went along with them, playing happily on pipes, and took no thought of the treachery. Those others saw them, and made a rush, and quickly thereafter cut off on both sides the herds of cattle and the beautiful flocks of shining sheep, and killed the shepherds upon them. But the other army, as soon as they heard the uproar arising from the cattle, as they sat in their councils, suddenly mounted behind their light-footed horses, and went after, and soon overtook them. These stood their ground and fought a battle by the banks of the river, as they were making casts at each other with their spears, bronze-headed, and hate was there with confusion among them, and death the destructive Thanatos. Line 535. She was holding a live man with a new wound, and another one unhurt, and dragged a dead man by the feet through the carnage. The clothing upon her shoulders showed strong red with the men's blood. All closed together like living men and fought with each other and dragged away from each other the corpses of those who had fallen. He made upon it a soft field, and this he, of course, is Hephaestus, the pride of the tilled land, wide and triple ploughed with many ploughmen upon it, who wheeled their teams at the turn and drove them in either direction. And as these, making their turn, would reach the end strip of the field, a man would come up to them at this point and hand them a flagon of honey-sweet wine, and they would turn again to the furrows in their haste to come again to the end strip of the deep field. The earth darkened behind them and looked like earth that has been plowed, though it was gold. Hephaestus is so good making this of gold that where they've already plowed looks darker than the spot where they have not plowed. We're still on line 549. Such was the wonder of the shield's forging. He made on it, Hephaestus made on it, the precinct of a king, where the laborers were reaping, with the sharp reaping hooks in their hands. Of the cut swaths, some fell along the lines of reaping, one after another, while the sheaf binders caught up others and tied them with bind ropes. There were three sheaf binders who stood by, and behind them were children picking up the cut swaths, and filling their arms with them, and carried, and gave them always, and by them the kings in silence, and holding his staff, stood near the line of the reapers happily. And, apart and under a tree, the heralds made a feast ready, and trimmed a great ox they had slaughtered. Meanwhile the women scattered, line 560, for the workmen to eat abundant white barley. He made on it a great vineyard, heavy with clusters, lovely and in gold, but the grapes upon it were darkened, and the vines themselves stood out through poles of silver. About them he made a field ditch of dark metal, and drove all around this a fence of tin, and there was only one path to the vineyard, and along it ran the grape-bearers for the vineyard's stripping. Young girls and young men, in all their light-hearted innocence, carried the kind, sweet fruit away in their woven baskets, and in their midst a youth with a singing lyre played charmingly upon it for them, and sang the beautiful song for Linus in a light voice, and they followed him, and with singing and whistling and light dance steps of their feet kept time to the music. He made upon it a herd of horned straight oxen. The cattle were wrought of gold and of tin, and thronged in speed, and with lowing out of the dung of the farmyard to a pasturing place by a sounding river, and beside the moving field of a reed bed. The herdsmen were of gold who went along with the cattle, four of them, and nine dogs, shifting their feet, followed them. But among the foremost of the cattle, two formidable lions had caught hold of a bellowing bull, and he, with loud lowings, was dragged away as the dogs and the young men went in pursuit of him. But the two lions, breaking open the hide of the great ox, gulped the black blood and the inward guts, as meanwhile the herdsmen were in the act of setting and urging the quick dogs on them. But they, before they could get their teeth in, turned back from the lions, line 585, but would come and take their stand very close, and bayed and kept clear. And the renowned smith of the strong arms, Hephaestus, made on it, the shield for Achilles, a meadow large, and in a lovely valley for the glimmering sheep flocks, with dwelling places upon it, and covered shelters and sheepfolds. And the renowned smith of the strong arms made elaborate on it a dancing floor, like that which once in the wide spaces of Cnossus Daedalus built for Ariadne of the lovely tresses. There are notes in your study guide here for 591 and 592. Cnossus was the main city on the island of Crete, and Daedalus is the one who built the Minotaur's maze, and on this, we're hearing that this is a beautiful dancing floor, and that this dancing floor is similar to one that Daedalus built for Ariadne. And of course, Ariadne is the one who helps Jason escape, to kill the Minotaur and then escape and back again, get out. And Ariadne gave him a ball of string to take through. You remember that story. And Homer's just referring it to here. To this dancing floor was just like the one at Cnossus on the island of Crete that Daedalus built for Ariadne of the lovely tresses. And there were young men on it, and young girls sought for their beauty with gifts of oxen, dancing, and holding hands at the wrist. These wore the maidens long light robes, but the men, line 595, wore tunics of fine spun work and shining softly, touched with olive oil. And the girls wore fair garlands on their heads, while the young men carried golden knives that hung from sword belts of silver. At whiles, on their understanding feet, they would run very lightly, as when a potter crouching makes trial of his wheel, holding it close in his hands to see if it'll run smooth. At another time, they would form rows and run, rows crossing each other, and dancing. And around the lovely chorus of dancers stood a great multitude happily watching, while among the dancers two acrobats led the measures of song and dance revolving among them, line 605. He made on it the great strength of the ocean river, which ran around the uttermost rim of the shield's strong structure. Think of Oceanus in Homer's world. It runs around the edge of the round earth, and so it is appropriate for Hephaestus to decorate Achilles' new shield with Oceanus, the ocean river, running around the uttermost rim of the shield's structure. Line 608. Then after he had wrought this shield, which was huge and heavy, he wrought for him a corslet brighter than fire in its shining, and wrought him a helmet, massive and fitting close to his temples, lovely and intricate work, and laid a gold top ridge along it, and out of pliable tin wrought him leg armor. Thereafter, when the renowned smith of the strong arms had finished the armor, he lifted it and laid it before the mother of Achilles, and she, like a hawk, came sweeping down from the snows of Olympus and carried with her the shining armor, the gift of Hephaestus. And thus ends Book 18.